Paul Asaro. We're in a special edition of Live and Local here on FM 90.9. And as you could tell from an actual audience response, which we don't usually get, or at least if we do get one, I never hear it because I'm sitting in a studio over at WILL. But right now I'm sitting in a bar at the Blind Pig in downtown Champaign on Walnut Street. And Paul Asaro has his very own piano sitting in a corner here. And we have an audience as they opened up the place. No, they're not open at noon, as you're hearing the show at noon, but we are recording this in advance at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. And Paul, really appreciate your joining us on the show. And what was the tune we just heard?
That piece was called Riffs, as in jazz riffs. It was written by James P. Johnson, the father of the stride piano. I thought it would be a good representative tune to start out with. Stride piano style is what I've been playing for, well, my whole career. It's the basis of my style. And that, as you can hear, it had that has its feet in the ragtime era and in the jazz era at the same time. A lot of improvisation going on. But that's stuff I like to play. And James P. Johnson wrote a good number of these style tunes. And Riffs is just one of many. So
Most of the stuff you play is the first part of the 20th century of various
yes.
types?
Yeah, that's probably the best way to describe what I do is piano, jazz piano and ragtime kind of fused together. But jazz piano from the first half of the 20th century, exactly, pre-World War II. After the war and when bebop came along, jazz piano styles changed radically. They really did, and it's a whole different animal. And I was attracted to the earlier styles early on when I was a kid, and now I'm pretty locked into it. I like listening to modern jazz, but I can't play it. All my licks are fashioned for the first 50 to 60 years of the 20th century, which is. But I could go on and on about that.
well, we'll ask you to.
Yeah.
I actually heard your name from a colleague at WILL, one of our news guys at the companion station AM 580, Jeff Bossert, said, you know, there's this great rag pianist who lives right here in Champaign and is here in town now and then. You seem to be a pretty well-kept secret, but at the same time, people who come to the Blind Pig must get to hear you now and then because you're here whenever you're in town. What are you doing? How did you end up in Champaign, and where did you start?
Well, how I ended up here is a long story, but...
We got about 50 minutes.
I bounced around a lot, obviously, as a professional musician. I was based in Chicago for the longest part of my career. I finished college there and started playing before I even graduated. I was playing professionally. And at that time, which was 1989 or so, 1990 thereabouts, the jazz musicians, I was already playing ragtime piano and had been since I was a kid, but I had never really heard live traditional jazz, or Dixieland, as people call it, or Chicago-style jazz. And all of a sudden, I transferred schools. I went to Columbia College downtown Chicago, and I pulled out the Chicago Reader, and I found you could just walk to places from my dormitory and go listen to live jazz. And I went to these places, and especially a place called Dick's Last Resort. I went there first. And the guys on the stand, I mean, I remember Franz Jackson was there. Franz Jackson played with Earl Hines. He played with Billie Holiday. He played with James P. Johnson. And his career went back to the 20s. Truck Parham was there. Truck Parham knew Jelly Roll Morton. He played with Roy Eldridge in the 30s. And these guys just invited me up to play with them every night that I showed up. And I began to sit in with these guys.
So you were how old at that point?
I had to sneak in. I was still 20. I wasn't allowed to be in the Dick's Last Resort yet, but those guys got me in, and pretty soon I started to pick up jobs. I mean, you know, I started to get enough skill that I started getting calls, and once I started playing, I just kept going in that direction. And pretty soon I started traveling a lot. And I bounced around. I lived in Seattle for a few years, and I worked on the river boats down in New Orleans for about 5 years. And then my brother, my younger brother was going to school here at the University of Illinois, and at a time when I really needed it, I moved in with him. Mm-hmm. Because, frankly, it's really inexpensive here.
I didn't know that that the riverboat business was still a going concern. For some reason, I would have thought that was decades and decades ago, or more.
Up until just a few years ago, the Delta Queen Steamboat Company had been going strong since the early 60s, and their flagship was an original 1927, I believe, steamship, the Delta Queen, and I ended up getting a call for that job. The way I've gotten every job, by the way, is not through auditioning. I always get recommended by somebody. You meet musicians, and eventually you get a recommendation, and a friend of mine, a cornet player, ended up being the band leader on that boat, which was convenient, so he called me. And you lived on the boat. You could do as much as 6 weeks at a time, and it was an original old steamboat, and it wasn't cheap, and it was booked way in advance. I mean, it was, you had to get on that thing. It was tough, but they treated the musicians really right. It was much better than, say, the cruise line industry. Cruise ships, frankly, try to get musicians as cheaply as possible, preferably right out of college, and not the Delta Queen. All of their musicians in that band, it was a real jazz band, real five-piece band. Everybody either came right out of New Orleans, or in my case, I was from Chicago. And wow, it was a great band. It paid great. It had health insurance. You got to be kidding me. It was the only music job I've ever heard of with health insurance. Those were the good old days. They had some trouble after 9/11. The travel industry took a hit, and they had, I don't know, this and that and the other thing. But what really got them is the Coast Guard had been after them for years because the steamship was so old they wanted to take it off the river. It has a wooden superstructure, and they considered it a fire hazard, and they finally succeeded in shutting it down, which is a shame. But it was a great job.
Has it been replaced with anything?
Well, I don't know. The company keeps changing hands, and I try to keep up with it. They had two other boats on the Mississippi that were built recently, one in the 70s and one in the 90s, and I don't know what's become of them. I'll have to look and see. I mean, I hope it's still going. It was a great place for performers. I don't remember that. As a pianist, I played all day and night. I mean, I played for everything. I played the calliope on the top deck, and I played for dinner piano, and I played all the shows, jazz band in the bar, and it's really interesting when I read the jazz biographies of how similar it was, although much more comfortable than the riverboats I read about in the 20s, which I'm sure had zero air conditioning.
But still, it sounds like basically the same gig.
Yeah, basically.
With the exception of amenities.
Yep.
Well, hear about some of the other things you've done and some of the other things you're doing, but let's hear a little more music. Before you pick something else, you mentioned the first piece you played, James P. Johnson, of stride piano, and then there's ragtime, and then there's other styles as well. What's the difference specifically between stride and ragtime?
Yeah, that's the question I get the most often from people, and stride piano isn't a word you hear that often anymore. You either hear, most people are familiar with the term ragtime. And the thing of it is stride piano is a little bit of both, because, as you know, in history, things don't just happen all at once. It was sort of gradual. Scott Joplin's famous rag was called the Maple Leaf Rag. Most people know that. And the manner that he wrote it more or less sounded like this. Thank you. that's just the first half of that piece. Thanks. And the Stride piano players came along later. That piece was written in 1899, and it sold a million copies. It was a huge hit, and it sort of set the standard for what a ragtime piano composition was supposed to sound like, and it was supposed to be written like. It was definitely it made Scott Joplin the king of ragtime writers, and it was his most successful piece. Well, later on, the Stride piano players came out of the New York City area in Harlem, and guys like James P. Johnson, Willie the Lion Smith, and later on Fats Waller and different guys like that, they all started out as ragtime piano players. But as music is constantly evolving, and in the late teens, the popular thing was jazz. All of a sudden, the original Dixieland jazz band starts selling a lot of records, and the ragtime pianists began to experiment with jazz in the ragtime, is the best I could say it. So if I take a tune like the Maple Leaf Rag, I'm going to play it in what I consider a Stride piano manner. For one thing, it swings like jazz, and there's also a fair amount of improvisation in the style. So let's see where we go with this.
Before you start, doesn't it also have a lot to do with what the left hand is doing, the term right. Stride?
Right, in ragtime. Got this kind of oompa. It represents the tuba and sometimes the trombone in a marching band. Comes right out of the marching band. And the Stride piano players took that and made it sound a little bit more like, say, a string bass in a jazz combination. So it would sound, let's see. More of the pluck of a string bass, and a lot more variation in the notes that are used. So you might have, if that makes sense. And then the right hand, instead of the, let's say, well, I'll use this second strain, sounds like this. So in the Stride piano, maybe you would go up an octave a little higher and do a little improvisation like this. It's the Maple Leaf Rag corrupted with jazz.
Souped up a little bit.
Souped up.
Well, a lot of the Stride thing, I mean, a lot of our folks here can't, actually probably hardly any of you can see this very well. Your left hand is actually traveling a lot more most of the time than it would be doing in that rag style, right?
Yes, wider intervals.
Is that the reason for the Stride term?
I think so.
Because a stride is typically like a long step.
Right. And I think it's a little bit of a combination. It has to do with that swinging motion of the left hand, but it also has to do with the way the music is supposed to feel, which is more of a strut than a stride. Like you're striding down the street. It's like if you've got a new suit on and you're strutting down the street. It has that kind of a feel. And those guys wanted to get that kind of a feel out of the piano. For them, it wasn't about how fast you could play or that kind of a thing. It was getting that kind of swinging feel in the right hand just a little bit behind the beat. Stride. Thank you. So it has that kind of a striding or strutting feel. That piece was called Carolina Shout. That was James P. Johnson's most famous stride composition. It was recorded in 1921, and it kind of kicked off the whole craze for that kind of music, although it was more of a musician's music than a huge hit with the public. But all the piano players, certainly on the East Coast and where most of the recording was being done in New York, all began playing stride piano. In the 1920s, that was the jazz piano style. It was just the way that all those guys played. And James P. Johnson almost single-handedly began that sound or that style, along with a few others such as Lucky Roberts and UB Blake. But and that was the piece. And he based it, a lot of it anyway, on dancing.
Johnson.
James P. Johnson. He played for dancers, he talks about, in like a basement in New York, in Hell's Kitchen or something like that. But there were, that was the time of the migrations of black Americans coming from the South up to the North. And they were bringing dances and things that they were doing down in the South. And he said there were a bunch of people from the Carolinas. They called themselves Geechies. I don't know a whole lot
about
them.
What?
The Geechies.
Geechies.
Geechies. And they, it's from South Carolina. South Carolina. And they came up, and they had a certain kind of dance that they used to do. And a lot of it was also based in religion. So, for instance, in this tune, you hear the call and response pattern from a church with the preacher and the congregation. You have the call and response. It goes. That kind of a thing. And that became a big part of stride piano, was trying to do something that would make the dancers respond to his playing.
What about Jelly Roll Morton? He's another player you mentioned in your sort of list of styles that you cover, at least when you're doing solo, or I guess with various other groups. What's the difference between what he would have done and what Johnson would have done?
Of course, Jelly Roll came up in New Orleans. I started out...
And he preceded James P. Johnson, didn't he?
Yes.
He claimed to have invented jazz, but he claimed a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he was a big talker, but he also had so much to offer. He's really interesting. He claimed to have invented jazz, which no one person can make that claim. What he did do, though, was invent, as many other piano players did, the really good ones anyway, his own style. He did come up with his own style, and in New Orleans, there were a lot of ragtime piano players, which he talks about at length in his interviews. And in order to compete, he came up with his own way of doing things, which was really quite interesting. Jelly Roll Morton's approach to jazz piano, solo jazz piano, was to imitate a band, whereas a lot the stride piano players, a lot of what they're doing is came out of ragtime piano and was what we call pianistic. It's based on tricks that you can do on the piano. For instance, now that kind of thing wouldn't be suited to a horn or to the human voice by any means. It's strictly a pianistic kind of a thing. Jelly Roll Morton decided that he would slow the tempo down, for one thing, is he didn't want to compete with all these hotshot New Orleans piano players that could play faster than him. He said, well, I'll just slow it down. And by doing that, he could play longer lines in the right hand that imitated a horn or a brass band or more of that kind of thing. So what he would do, let's see, like here's a tune. He used to play Darktown Strutter's Ball. A lot of people know this one. Now he would take it. And in the left hand, you're going to hear imitations of the trombone. And in the right hand, more of an imitation of a clarinet or trumpet, playing a longer line. That kind of a thing. So he would go... Um, Yeah. Man, that's a great style. I discovered Jelly Roll Morton later. I had been playing stride piano and ragtime for a long time, and when I was in my late 20s or so, I got the offer to play for a Jelly Roll Morton show, a national touring one-man show called Jelly Roll, the Music and the Man, that had been playing off-Broadway for several years. It was written by Vernell Bonnierice and Morten Gunnar Larsen, and the play was written based on the Library of Congress interviews with Jelly Roll Morton. So most of the dialogue was straight from Jelly's own mouth, his own words, and certainly the piano pieces were all, you know, in his style. They were either direct transcriptions from records or things written down in his style. And it really introduced me to Jelly Roll's piano, and I just fell in love with it, just that groove that he would get. And the other thing that he used to do was what he called the Spanish tinge. There was this Latin music coming into New Orleans, and there was a little bit of it in Harlem, but there was a lot more of it in New Orleans. He wrote a piece called The Crave, which I would love to play. This is a Jelly Roll Morton's version of a tango, and it's one of my favorite pieces by Jelly. And here we go.
Called Crave?
Yes, the Crave.
The Crave of Jelly Roll Morton.
The Crave, yes.
We're listening to Paul Asaro, pianist in a live, sort of special edition of Live and Local. We're sitting at the Blind Pig bar, not the Blind Pig Brewery. There's actually two places called the Blind Pig in downtown Champaign. This is the one on Walnut Street. And Paul Asaro has his grand piano. Is that Steinway?
Is
that
it is, yes.
How did your piano get here? I mean, how did you land at the Blind Pig?
I've been here almost since it opened. It was my brother helped me out on this one. I had moved to Champaign, and I had a grand piano in my apartment. And the funny thing is, I wasn't playing it much. I actually play more when I leave the house. If I go somewhere else, like a practice room or something, I get more work done. It's hard to explain. I'm too distracted at home. Internet, the mail comes, anything you can think of to
I have a feeling that's pretty common.
Me, you know? Yeah. So anyway, we moved a little upright piano into the Blind Pig. My brother set it up for me. He was the smart one. He knew what I needed. And at the time, this room here didn't exist. It was just that half over there. So I had a little piano over there by the bar, and I played there for a couple of years. And then this new room opened up, and I had room for a grand piano, so I moved this in. And I just love having a place to play. When I'm off the road, I can come in here. I can practice during the day. I have a key to the building. And then I can try out my pieces at night in front of an audience. And it's, I have the freedom. I don't get paid, but I also have complete freedom. I can play whatever nights I want, which is also why I seem to be, like you said, hard to find.
a well-kept secret.
Yeah, a well-kept secret.
Very
that was
well
the
kept
phrase.
Secret.
A very well-kept secret.
You mentioned, Paul, the show Jelly Roll. You didn't mention that it actually won an Obie Award on
That's
Broadway.
Right.
And you also didn't mention that, at least according to your bio here, you got a Best Supporting Actor nomination for, at least in Philadelphia, for a
in
run
Philadelphia,
there.
Yeah, I remember that. I got it in the mail. I couldn't go to the ceremony, but I thought that was a hoot. The way the show was set up, the grand piano was on stage, not in the pit, and I dressed up in a period suit, and I didn't speak you don't speak a word through the whole thing. You just play the piano, and then the actor, in this case Vernell Bonnieris or whoever it happened to be, would do the entire 80-minute show as a one act. It's tricky for the actor, that's for sure. But they considered me to be a supporting actor on being on stage, even though I really didn't do anything but play. That was it.
Well, if you did a show about Jelly Roll Morton and nobody was playing the piano, that would be a problem.
Right.
Probably be kind of dull on the musical side of things. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you are doing now, because you've made reference to going out on the road a lot. I mean, particularly working with Leon Redbone.
Yes.
And I'm actually blanking. I should have looked this up ahead of time, and I told myself to do it many times, and I just can't remember. What does Leon Redbone play?
Oh, well, guitar, and of course
and singing.
Known for a vocalist.
Yeah.
Yeah, known for being a vocalist.
What style?
A lot of people ask that. He also likes the first half of the 20th century when it comes to his music. And he's got an interesting blend. It's not just one thing. He's into some ragtime. He's very much into a guitar player, a blues guitar player and ragtime player named Blind Blake, who you've got a lot of inspiration from, I think, in his guitar playing. He's very much influenced by Emmett Miller, an old minstrel singer who made some records in the late 20s, and of tunes that, like I Ain't Got Nobody, and things that were very much performed later on. And so he takes his influence from old country music before they called it country music, vaudeville, and Tin Pan Alley, mostly from the 1920s and early 30s, and some from the teens. So he's interesting.
So that's kind of your main ongoing gig right now?
Yeah, that's the one that keeps me the most busy. The rest of the time I try to play some solo piano. There's various festivals, some ragtime festivals, some jazz festivals.
You have a trio?
And things. I had, not recently, I haven't done the trio, but a couple of times I've managed to get out and do some what they call community concerts. You do a two-month tour, mostly throughout the Midwest, for a subscription concert series. And recently I've been doing that solo, though, which is fine. Been actually concentrating more on my solo playing. So
I remember when I was a kid, we always had the community concert series back in Pennsylvania. We used to go see lots of stuff like that, and I think they still have it going on, and I assume that's kind of connected to the Midwest version.
Yep.
And then are you still working with Loudon Wainwright III? You did a recording with him not too long ago.
Yeah, that's right. I've done two concerts with him now that have been based on that recording, the music of Charlie Poole, the old-time singer and banjo player. And we had another one scheduled tentatively in New York City, but it hasn't gotten a date attached.
It's still tentative.
Yeah. So hopefully I'll be able to work with him again. Yeah.
You said you actually surprised me before we started to record here, and maybe I did see one of the video clips of your doing this, that you also sing as well as play.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
I've been known to.
I'm setting you up. It's time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let me try one of these tunes. This is something that Fats Waller recorded in one of his first recording sessions with a little band he called his Rhythm in 1934. I love doing this tune. This is called I Wish I Were Twins. So now when I'm with you, I feel so small. Right in my shell, I wanna crawl. I wonder why I had to fall for you. Why do you make my life so tough? It seems I can't love you half enough. You're so heavenly, you're much too much for me. I wish that I were twins, you great big baby kins. I could love you twice as much as I do. I'd have four loving arms to embrace you, four eyes to idolize you each time I trace you. And with two hearts twice as true, what good would four lips do when four ears keep telling me that I'm yours? I wish that I were twins, you great big babykins. I'd love you twice as much as I do. Piano has a jam. I can love you twice as much as I do. Well, I'd have four loving arms to embrace you, four eyes to idolize you each time I trace you. And with two hearts twice as true, what good would four lips do when four ears keep telling me that I'm yours? Yes, yours. I wish that I were twins, you great big babykins. I can love you twice as much as I do.
That was Fats Waller live on Live and Local here. Paul Asaro doing a Fats Waller tune. And I'm guessing you were sort of trying to imitate his own singing style.
It's hard not to.
Yeah,
the problem with a tune like that.
When you play somebody else's tune, whether it's James B. Johnson, Jelly Roll Morton, or whoever,
right,
how much do you try to adopt their style versus just playing the tune Paul's way?
Exactly. That's tricky. And when I started out, when I was younger, I would simply copy the solos off the records. And a lot of jazz musicians, whether you're modern or not, learn that way. It was the only way I had to learn. And but recently, over time, I went back and I would tweak them around and try to get my own arrangement. Stride piano pieces are similar to ragtime piano in that they have a set structure. They're not anywhere near as free as, say, a modern, more bebop-oriented tune would be. They're more structured. So it's a balance. It's a balance between playing what, say, James P. Johnson intended as a composer to be in the piece, but also playing it with your own style, which is what all those guys did back then.
Are you able to, put you on the spot here, are you able to take a tune that you learned off of a record, say, and maybe give us an example of how that person played it and then how you've altered it for yourself?
Ooh, that's good. Let me think. Let me think of one. That's a good question. I'm trying to think of a good example here. Because
I mean, you may well have put them out of your mind enough. That
yeah, that's one
don't do
that's
it
tough because a lot of them well, I never play them the same way twice, most of them. And that goes especially for Jelly Roll Morton, but the Stride tunes as well. Oh, well, here's one. This is Willie the Lion Smith, who was a very original composer from the Harlem Stride School. It's a piece called Echo of Spring. And he more or less played it on the record. He recorded it in 39. Let me think. He kind of recorded it fast. I'm trying to think of the record now. I love that composition, but I like to put a little more emotion into it. He kept the tempo going, and probably from night after night after night of playing in loud nightclubs in New York City, he played it with a lot of force. But I like to do this piece more in this kind of a vein. Same key. Thank you.
Balasaro here on Live and Local. We're doing a special edition of the show at the Blind Pig in downtown Champaign, where Paul has his Steinway. I wanted to ask you, Paul, about sort of the difference between playing solo, as you said you're particularly concentrating on now when you're not playing with Leon Redbone, and when you're playing with a larger group. Like you said, you have held down the quote-unquote piano chair in bands like Chicago Jazz Ensemble, Independence Hall Jazz Band, which is different from the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
Yeah.
Spats Langham and his Rhythm Boys, Vince Giordano's Nighthawks. How do you play differently? How do you have to do you sublimate yourself?
Well, it's helped that I love record collecting because I've done a lot of listening. That's really a big part of the way that I've done it, playing with bands. But the rest of it is, once again, I thank those old timers in Chicago that let me sit in all those years. I mean, that was my first introduction to it. And those were generally six-piece traditional jazz units, but they with a swing rhythm section, a string bass, and maybe guitar and drums, rather than, say, a New Orleans would have a tuba and maybe a banjo in the rhythm section. But in Chicago, it was a string bass, and it was more of a swinging feel, which helped me because later on, when I started to play with big bands, I had more of an idea of what to do. And then I listened to a lot of records. For instance, Count Basie started out as a stride piano player. So did Duke Ellington and Fletcher Henderson, these great big band swing leaders from the 30s and 40s started out as stride piano players. So it gave me an idea. I just listened to what they did. So a guy like Basie, he would take, let's see, I'm just going to use this Fats Waller tune. It's called A Handful of Keys. Stride piano, it would be. And I noticed that a lot of what Basie was doing when he was playing with the band was stride piano licks in the right hand, and he just dropped the left hand. And he wouldn't play as much. But he would still maybe, you have to kind of imagine the bass is going. To me, those are stride licks in the right hand, just much sparser, and that's kind of how I started to play with big bands, and gave me an idea of what to do anyway, if that makes sense.
Well, it sounds like he's, in his case, just sort of outlining tunes from, outlining the way he would play it if he were just played solo.
If he was playing solo, just not as many notes, and much less left hand. Ellington started doing the same thing. But he started to use those big chords. He would just play these big, and where Basie would kind of stay up on the top of the piano. And then Ellington might do, you know. He'd cover the whole keyboard, but he'd keep it sparse. And Ellington was I played his pieces with the Chicago Jazz Ensemble. It was a repertory orchestra. They did a lot of Duke Ellington, a lot of Count Basie, and some Stan Kenton and things like that. And that's what got me interested in what those guys were doing on the piano behind the band. And Ellington was tough. Wow, that was tough to figure that stuff out. I just wanted to at least approximate it so that I could. I didn't want to copy what they did. I played my own solos. I improvised my own solos, but I just wanted to get a handle on the way that they would voice chords and stuff so that it would fit their music, especially with Ellington, because he was such a great composer and a great arranger. I wanted to, you know, and he really did play those big. I mean, he would just do stuff like that. He was great. It gave me a whole new appreciation, by the way, of Ellington as a pianist. Everybody talks about him as a band leader and a great composer. He was a great pianist, I think, and I love the way he voiced chords and stuff. It's just real meaty, you know. It's just beautiful stuff. But anyway.
Well, we do have you here solo, of course. Yeah. Ellington's not here. No band is here. So why don't we let you take us out with another solo tune. We've been listening to Paul Asaro live, not in our studio here on Live and Local. It's a special edition of the show. We're recorded here at the Blind Pig in downtown Champaign. And Paul's own Steinway is here. And so he talked us into coming over here. And it's been fun to do it. And it's fun to actually have an audience for the show. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. And thanks to you, Paul,
sure,
for doing it.
All right. Well, I think I'll do one of the flashy pieces. Stride pianists were famous for these. This is an arrangement based on a record made by Donald Lambert. Here's a stride piano player that almost no one knows about. He was very obscure, but really great. And I have a whole lot of tapes of him, mostly home recordings. He used to do stride piano variation on an old number called The Golden Wedding. And so let's see where we go. This is one of those fast things. So, oh boy.